Ladies and gentlemen, the sound you hear is a buzzsaw ripping through a painting of George Washington chopping down cherry trees. It's time for Professor Buzzkill, busting myths and taking names.
Hello, hello, Buzzkillers. It's the old professor here, and we're in studio with one of your other favorite professors, Professor Phil Nash from Penn State. We're going to talk about the myths and misconceptions about Woodrow Wilson, one of the most famous presidents in the United States. Good morning, Professor Nash.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm very well. I hope you're doing well.
Oh, yes, I am.
I hope we're both better than Woodrow Wilson was at the end of his career, bedridden and wheelchair-ridden.
Bitter.
Bitter, yeah. Oh, we're bitter. Don't get me wrong about that. But we want to talk about Wilson because not only is he a fascinating president, but he's a president at the time when the U.S. sort of opens up onto the world stage and all kinds of other big things happen, a lot of innovations, a lot of reforms. It's a very dynamic part of American history, dynamic period. So can you give us a little brief background on Wilson and what, you know, where he's from, where he grew up, how he became a politician, all that sort of stuff?
Right, absolutely. He's born in, I believe, 1856. He's a...
Before
the Civil War.
Holy
and a son of the South. Grew up from in Virginia, which, and we'll talk about that later, that's actually important.
Oh, most people think of him as Princeton, New Jersey kind of guy.
Right. Well, that's where he spends, elite education, spends most of his career early on as an academic. By the way, last time we had a PhD in the White House, maybe a good thing.
Oh, wait a minute.
That typically doesn't end well.
I'm working on a campaign for 20 whatever.
In the late 19th century, he was one of the most prominent political scientists in the country. Had a lot of prestigious teaching positions, wrote a book on, I think it was called Congressional Government.
Uh-huh.
He was actually a big fan of the British parliamentary system, which is interesting. But this was also a period in time when Congress was dominant and presidents were relatively weak.
Oh, even after Teddy Roosevelt?
Oh, no, pre-Teddy Roosevelt. Oh,
okay.
You know.
Oh, when he was young, growing up and being...
Late 19th century. This is the period between Lincoln and TR when we've had this long string of bearded presidents from Ohio that... never make it onto our money.
Hey, don't diss Ohio. It's the first place of presidents.
Sorry. No, it's true. Because it was a swing state. But
by the way, Buzzkills, we got to remind you of a historian slang here. TR means Teddy Roosevelt.
Yes.
And always will.
And always will. Yes. That's right. That's been that number's been retired. So in any case, so he's a prominent academic, but then basically becomes first president of Princeton University. And then he becomes governor of New Jersey. 1910, I believe. Mm-hmm. And that's basically a springboard into the White House. He runs in the unbelievably fascinating election of 1912, which is an election when, and this, who knows how relevant that'll be this year, who knows, but you had a split in the Republican Party. You had the incumbent William Howard Taft, sort of he was surprisingly progressive, but sort of an old guard style Republican compared to his opponents. Teddy Roosevelt, who had been two-term president between 01 and 09, immediately regretted only limiting himself to two terms.
Well, did he actually run again, Teddy?
Yeah, he runs. He runs in 1912, but as an independent, so-called as a bull moose progressive, and actually gets many more electoral votes than the incumbent Taft does.
We should bring back the bull moose party. It's just
absolutely
a fantastic image.
I know. I love that. Yeah,
we get the Canadian vote.
I'll be drinking Molson in no time.
Well, Ted Cruz, needs it.
And by the way, often forgotten, 1912 was also an election when we have a socialist candidate for president.
Eugene Debs.
Eugene Debs, who gets almost a million votes in this country, which
that's
is
incredible.
Pretty... Yeah, so it was essentially a four-way race.
Yeah.
And then I would say all this because the split in the Republican Party is what allows the Democrat Woodrow Wilson to be elected president.
Right, he has something like 40-some-odd percent of the popular vote, but kills it in the electoral
college.
That's
right. That's right. Exactly. Yeah. Our system tends to do that. But by the way, this is in the middle of a period of Republican dominance. And the only reason you have a Democratic president in this period is because there's this split and Woodrow Wilson wins.
Okay.
But the other way you should look at it is in that election, basically three-quarters of Americans vote for a progressive candidate of some kind. Either
you can put Debs in there.
Right, exactly. If you include Debs, Wilson, or Teddy Roosevelt. Mm-hmm. So this was sort of the peak of sort of progressive consensus in this country.
Now, also, we need to remind the Buzzkillers that this is 1912. Now, this is not 1917. when the Russian Revolution is coming along, socialism is might be intellectually critiqued, but it wasn't a boogeyman.
Correct.
Bunny stretch, but that it was for the next
This is when the IWW, for example, is on the rise. You have so-called
International Workers of the World.
Correct. Industrial Workers of the
World. Oh, industrial. Sorry.
Yes,
sorry.
Sorry. You have socialists being elected at the local level, so-called gas and water socialists. I think it may have been a little later, but Milwaukee had a socialist mayor.
Because they're to gas and water because they're actually just trying to solve local problems.
Exactly.
Utilities and
exactly
they're
right
bread
they're,
and butter issues
right they're using the power of the government and just going a little farther than say a Democrat or a Bull Mooser would go but so Wilson's elected president in 1912 and establishes a pretty good progressive record
Can you explain what did they mean by progressive at that time,
right? Especially since these days sometimes that term gets abused
and mean a lot of different things,
right? Well, at the most basic level, it suggests a belief that humans can sort of progress. In other words, humans are capable of improving their situation in their society, often by working together,
right?
In other words, not just sort of relying on individual efforts but working starting with sort of grassroots activism, and this is more in the U.S. context. Obviously, progressive is a much more general word, but in the U.S. context, it means working at the grassroots to organize, to basically put pressure on government to address some of the ills that have cropped up as a result of Gilded Age industrial capitalism.
Now, Gilded Age industrial capitalism has a sort of connotation of being capitalism out of control.
Exactly.
Bad worker conditions.
No limits. And like I said, implied a minute ago with sort of the congressional government thing, the Office of the Presidency is very weak. The Supreme Court after the Civil War is extremely conservative and sort of almost obsessed with protecting private property in the broadest possible definition.
Yeah.
And so you have a lot of the abuses, today you see in places like China. In other words, there are no worker protections, no environmental protections, no minimum wage, no child labor laws.
So the Industrial Revolution is going, full speed ahead, but people's lives and their health are being ignored.
And by the early 20th century, it's quite clear what sort of the collateral damage is from unfettered industrial capitalism. So, and progressivism, it is, even though in a way it's a reaction to that, the opposite term. they are reacting, and it seems like the only thing that you have available to sort of counterbalance the power of big business is the government.
Okay.
And so, in these days, in many circles, quote unquote, big government is a bad word.
Right.
Back then, it was the only option you had if you wanted to rein in the power of the so-called robber barons, right? The John D. Rockefellers and the J.P. Morgans, those folks. Mm-hmm. The only option you had was to sort of increase the power of this countervailing force known as government.
Right, and probably apart from a few states, most states are too weak to try to hold back a Frick or a Carnegie or a Mellon or anybody like that.
That's true, although, and certain things only make sense when you do them nationally.
Right.
But it is very much a sort of bottom-up movement. To the extent that progressivism is a movement, is it does sort of start at the local and state level, and some of the most influential progressives, like Bob La Follette in Wisconsin, for example, are working at the state level, and then it sort of percolates to the top. And by the time you get to around, the first decade of the 20th century, politicians like Teddy Roosevelt, any good politician has a moist finger in the wind, trying to detect the direction of the country, and he realizes that there's a lot of popular support for, balancing against the power of capital. And so, you see it already under Teddy Roosevelt with things like the Square Deal and the way he settles the anthracite coal strike, those sorts of things.
So Wilson is a progressive. There are a lot of progressives around, not only in government, but in academia and in, even things like literature. You tend to see things, novels and stuff written from a progressive slant.
Sure.
But as we talked about before we started the show, one of the things we like to do, because it's important that we do it, is complicate the picture. So you talked a lot about complicating Wilson's progressivism. It's not necessarily what someone might think the idea of progressive means all the time.
Right. Right.
So how does that happen? I mean, how is it complicated?
Right. In other words, you can call him a progressive, but then you should also keep in mind the ways in which he was not progressive, or, for example, the major progressive causes that he really didn't subscribe to, one of which would be women's suffrage.
Right.
Women did not have the right to vote, at least nationally. They had the right to vote in some states.
Okay.
Uh, often from the Rocky Mountain West, which is interesting. Some of the first states to give women the right to vote were actually in the West.
Today, do you think that's a rugged individualist men country?
Right, exactly. Well, and today, some of today's most conservative states, but they were the first to give women the right to vote. In any case, Woodrow Wilson was not a supporter of women's suffrage.
Okay.
Until World War I, very late in the game. He has to be brought around, partly because, by the way, and I strongly recommend the HBO movie, what's it called? Iron-Jawed Angels. Which is about the radical suffragettes who would picket at the White House during the war and refer to Wilson as Kaiser Wilson.
Ooh.
Yeah, which them's fighting words.
Them is fighting words.
they were imprisoned and force-fed and all sorts of stuff.
Talk about buzz killers.
that would kill some buzz. In any case, so he was not at all progressive on every single issue. Certainly, I don't know, maybe we should talk about race at this point.
Yeah. Which we'll get back to. Oh no, we could segue into race. But actually, just before we do that, can I ask: is progressivism at this stage really more interested in people's sort of social and economic conditions, like improving people's daily lives, and giving certain people the vote is not as important as making sure they have safety at work,
right?
And so that if you have Wilson on the one hand who's anti female suffrage, but there might be people who said, progressives who said, look, that can wait.
Sure.
Far more important things.
Right, right. And you shouldn't read the absence in the one case back into the other cases.
Gotcha.
If you're saying, but you would have all sorts of Republicans who were in favor of women's suffrage and all sorts of Democrats who were not, right? Keep in mind also that in terms of the political system, both parties have wings.
Right.
Unlike today.
Yeah.
You had conservative Southern Democrats and you had liberal Republicans. But yeah, you're right. It would be more often on other issues. Although there were also progressivism also included political reforms, like for example, institution of the referendum, because state legislatures were often sort of beholden to capital,
right?
And so a lot of states like California, they introduced the referendum so that the people, quote unquote, the people could put something on the ballot because the state legislature never would.
They wouldn't want to overrule Leland Stanford and people like
that. Exactly. Although, of course, these days, sometimes the referendum process is also perverted for corporate interests.
Well, I remember when I lived in California, I was tired of the fact that there were too many referendum items.
Yes, like any reform, it can be abused.
Right.
But back then, that was a very important progressive reform.
Okay, you were going to move on to race there a minute ago, right. And I stopped you and asked you to step back a minute. So what is it about? Is race one of the big sort of exceptions in Wilson's progressivism?
Yeah, I mean, I would say so, although once again, at the time, that would not have been considered a sort of a contradiction.
Okay,
You had some of the most progressive people were also big fans of sort of Jim Crow segregation. Yeah, and just for context, remember this is one of the darkest periods in American history when it comes to race relations. This is the so-called African American nadir, the lowest point in Black history, apart from slavery, obviously.
Uh-huh.
Sort of post emancipation, right? This is a period of, and keep in mind, 80-90% of the Black population still lives in the South in this period. So they've been disenfranchised, they're not allowed to vote.
The Klan is going through one of its big revivals.
The Klan is about to revive, 1915. Strict legal segregation everywhere. African Americans basically non-citizens in their own country. All enforced by terror in the form of lynching. It was a horrible, horrible period. So, and this is important today too, because if you look this up at Princeton University, sort of as we speak, there are people who want to take Woodrow Wilson's name down.
Sure.
From dorms and things like that because he was a racist. Now, as many people correctly point out, this is a time when racism, certainly among the white elites, was perfectly acceptable, even expected.
That's an interesting idea.
No, I mean, true race progressives among white folks, they were a distinct minority. I mean, was it 1902? Teddy Roosevelt causes a huge scandal simply by having a black person in the White House as a guest.
Oh, no kidding.
Booker T. Washington.
Even though Washington was a huge, important person.
Exactly. And by the way, and sort of respected by a lot of white folks because of his very sort of moderate approach. But, up until this point, the only black people in the White House were supposed to be the help, essentially.
Sure.
And it caused a huge, huge outcry, especially among white Southerners.
Wow.
So that's where we are in the early 20th century. It's a horrible situation. So part of me wants to say, jumping on Woodrow Wilson for being a racist is kind of ahistorical. A lot of people were racists, and it was acceptable. On the other hand, He was also more racist than some other presidents, including Taft and Teddy Roosevelt.
Oh, well,
so for example, when he comes in, and remember, he's the first Democrat in 16 years, right?
Yeah. The previous at this stage, the Democratic Party is still the Southern Party.
It's
still
very much dominated by Southerners, no question about it. Well, at least you have to keep the Southern wing of the party happy. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So Wilson comes in 1913 and immediately appoints Southerners to his cabinet. He himself is essentially a Southerner.
Yeah.
And sort of grew up, right? He
even though we think of him as a New Jersey guy, really.
Right.
He even started college in the South. Yeah.
Yeah. And he sort of absorbed a lot of the views of Southern history, the lost cause, things like that. Mm-hmm. And so what he does among his many first sort of actions, and it's not a deliberate action, it's more sort of he allows it to happen. But basically the federal government is resegregated when he comes into office. It takes a step backwards. Yeah. Now, it's not like the federal government was, you know, completely progressive, right? But he, you know, there were African Americans who worked in the federal government, and so within a couple of years of him becoming president, all the cafeterias, all the restrooms, all the offices in all the federal buildings in D.C. are rigidly segregated. They put up curtains down the middle of some rooms.
You've got to be kidding!
So blacks on one side, whites on the other.
Wow.
He has some really tense and hostile interactions with civil rights leaders, including when they come to the White House.
Wow.
The one thing we should save him from is the myth.
Yeah.
Ding, 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 ding.
Yes, that's right. That's why we're here. That's why we get the big money, by the way, folks.
Is the myth, and you still see this in a lot of places, the myth that he endorsed D.W. Griffith's famous movie, Birth of a Nation.
Birth of a Nation, one of the earliest movies, certainly one of the most technologically advanced movies.
Absolutely.
Of the time, but landmark. Definitely a racist view of Southern history.
And that helped spread the view of sort of the Klan as the Ku Klux Klan as this honorable institution protecting the virtue of white womanhood against lascivious black males.
Right.
Right.
White knights and all that.
Yeah. All these sort of powerful tropes about race relations in Southern history are sort of propagated by this movie. The claim was that Woodrow Wilson saw the movie in the White House, which he did, and that afterwards he said it was essentially history written with lightning.
And that he really liked it and he approved it.
Yeah, right. And he said that it was all sadly all too terribly true.
Yeah.
This is, I dug in this a little bit, seems to be a myth.
Yeah, I found that he was actually quite disappointed with the movie.
Yes.
And that it was bad history.
Right. Well, and I think what I read is that not D.W. Griffith, but the author of the novel on which it's based, which is a book called The Klansman.
Yikes.
By Klansman with a C, by the way. The Klansman.
Oh, that's interesting.
The author is Thomas Dixon. The book came out, I think, in 1905, about 10 years before the movie. So the author of the book is trying to promote the movie and the book and then essentially claims, based on nothing, that Woodrow Wilson had said all these great things about the movie.
Including the famous, "This is history," written with lightning.
And apparently, and that actual quote may actually have come from much later. And there's certainly no evidence that Woodrow Wilson himself actually said that or wrote that. So it seems pretty clear that was made up. Okay. And then Wilson, through his press secretary, Joe Tumulty, he basically issues a statement saying that he found the movie disappointing and well, unfortunate was the word he used.
Well, I think that's a key word, unfortunate, because I think that does show us that he's saying, look, this is setting us back. This is glorifying something we don't want to glorify.
Right, and maybe, for example, helping to stir up race hatred, which even though he was a racist, he had no interest in sort of provoking race war in the United States.
Making things worse.
Right, exactly.
Right.
So, the idea that this was a sort of, we would call it marketing, right? You claim the president is endorsing your movie. You know, a popular president, when in fact it turns out not to be true.
Well, and you know how we are about made up quotes, bus killers. Not only do we like to bust them in terms of people not having said them or not being the first person to say them. One of the things that quotes does is it sort of condenses a whole historical idea or a person's philosophy into one statement, and then it's retailed a billion times, and it might not have been true.
That's
the person may never have said it. This seems to be the case with Wilson and the lightning quote.
Yep, it's correct.
Extremely
questionable. And, you know, and as I was mentioning earlier, very relevant today because, you know, it's an issue. People sort of condemn him as a racist, you know, and it gets into the whole thing. Should we be taking down flags and monuments and those sorts of things? Which hugely controversial, right? Huge, huge can of worms there.
Right, right. Because there are institutes named after Wilson and foreign affairs institutes and things like that.
Now, by the way, I've also seen historians who say, you know, because racism was prevalent, we should give Wilson a pass. Mm-hmm. And I would not go that far. Certainly, no, not if you look at things like the resegregation of the federal government. He didn't have to do that.
That's right. That's he was actively racist.
And he was sort of turning back the clock at least a little bit in terms of race progress. Uh-huh. I think he deserves criticism for that.
It's interesting because, it's interesting in its own right, but also Cecil Rhodes in Britain, there's a controversy going on about him. He's slightly earlier, but about whether he deserves to have statues and his old college in Oxford and things like that.
Right.
And it's a big debate. And, you know, historians in one way might have an opinion about whether a certain person needs to be honored. But what we love about this sort of thing is that it brings those issues back up again. And we hope people bring them up without retelling the myths over
and over again. Right.
But listen, we want to just take a break for a second, Buzzkillers, for a brief word about Patreon. And we'll be right back to talk more about Woodrow Wilson. Hello, Buzzkillers. You've always wanted to be a patron of the arts, haven't you? Well, now you can. Become a patron of Professor Buzzkill by clicking on the Patreon link at ProfessorBuzzkill.com. There are many levels of monthly pledges starting at only a dollar. And here's what you'll get in return. A warm feeling inside, the thanks of a grateful professor, shout-outs on the blog and podcast, coffee cups and t-shirts, and much, much more. But the most important thing is knowing that you'll be helping bring enlightenment to humanity. Thanks, Buzzkillers. Okay, and we're back with Professor Philip Nash from Penn State talking about Woodrow Wilson, who you told me over email the other day, you Americanists refer to him as the Woodman.
The Woodman, right.
It took me about 4 hours to stop laughing. Not only do I think of the Tin Man with his hatchet, but it just...
Either Woodman or Woody.
And he's,
although, by the way, Woodrow was his middle name.
Oh.
His name is Thomas Woodrow Wilson.
Okay.
Just so we're clear.
He presents this, where we have this image of him as very stern, serious,
yes. You know,
diplomatic sort of.
Very dour.
So for him to have any kind of nickname is a scream.
Yes.
So, Buzzkillers, you have our permission and our stamp of approval to call him the Woodman.
Yeah, I think he was one of our most uptight presidents. I think that's pretty safe to say.
But uptight is interesting because he definitely has various ideas, very strong philosophies.
Absolutely.
And one of them is about the United States' role in the world.
Right.
And he's an idealist in foreign affairs, isn't he?
Yeah. I mean, these days, people in foreign relations regularly use the term Wilsonian idealism.
Okay.
Or Wilsonian internationalism. I mean, that's still a really powerful and influential sort of theme in sort of our involvement in the world and in foreign relations history.
Okay, and by Wilsonian, it's almost always used in a positive way because
absolutely.
To have a worldview, to have a cooperative view.
Well, right. and as you sort of implied at the outset, this is a period when the United States is really becoming a world power.
Right.
We had sort of gained an overseas empire in 1898 under McKinley.
Mm-hmm.
We acquired the Philippines.
Our flung of the Philippines, yeah.
Right, Guam, Puerto Rico, et cetera, after picking the right enemy by going after Spain rather than, say, Great Britain. That was a shrewd move. And also with our industrial capacity, we are sort of in the forefront of world powers economically. And, you know, by 1914, everyone really wants us on their side in World War I for obvious reasons. But, you know, he's one of the first people to, in a full-throated way, to say the United States should play an active role in the world. That it should throw its new weight around and sort of cooperate with other countries to sort of reshape the world.
Right. But as you told me before, and as we've talked about before, one of the things we need to do with Wilson in order to help correct some of these misconceptions and some of this sort of stereotype of, is we need to complicate his ideas and his actions in foreign affairs. And you know how much we love the word complication, Buzzkillers.
Right.
You know, next to quote or no quote, it's our favorite word. So there's more to it than just he doesn't want world government. He doesn't want, you know, sorts of other things.
Right, absolutely not. But he does, you know, one of his big contributions is the idea that you put together an international organization to preserve the peace in the form of the League of Nations, which, by the way, if you look at them on paper, even though the League of Nations gets a bad rap for good reasons because it fails to stop World War II.
Right, yeah.
The United Nations, in terms of its design, the United Nations is actually a lot like the League of Nations.
Right.
Yeah. They obviously had to go through some rebranding when they created the United Nations. But at the time, and, you know, during World War I, the idea that you should prevent another war like this from breaking out by having an international organization, an international security organization,
right.
That was largely his idea.
Oh, no kidding.
The problem here, as some of your listeners probably are aware, is that there's a real fine line between wanting to sort of be active in the world and want to help the world and wanting to dominate the world mm-hmm. and wanting to tell the world how to behave. And this is where I think we really need to complicate the story of Woodrow Wilson. Because on the one hand, you know, he leads the country into war in 1917, largely for idealistic reasons.
Right.
Right. It's about neutral rights. It's about protecting America's right to travel.
Not
be killed by German submarines, right?
Lusitania and things like that.
You know, things like the Zimmerman telegram also piss us off a great deal, right? The idea that the Germans would go to war against us and that Mexico would join the Germans to get all their land back that we had stolen in the mid-19th century.
Right. This is a telegram supposedly sent
by the German foreign minister, his name was Zimmerman, to the German ambassador in Mexico, which British intelligence gleefully handed over to the Americans because they knew we'd be angry, and we were.
And the idea that British intelligence handing over to was, if we give this to the Americans, they're gonna help us out.
Right, absolutely. So, you know, he sees the United States as a force for good, but, you know, they're also more realistic. You know, the dichotomy is always between idealism and realism, which is all often a false one. But mm-hmm. we also go to war for some realistic reasons. For example, we had been leaning very heavily toward the British and the French during the war, during the period of the war where we were not yet in it, 1914 to 1917. Yeah. Partly because we had lent the British and the French a lot of money so they could continue to buy our goods. Mm. Our economy had become dependent on selling things to the British and French. And if they lose, then our banks don't get their money back.
Yeah, my students used to ask me, it seems as if the United States military eventually chased U.S. money that was invested more on one side than the other.
Right. We had an economic interest. Mm-hmm. That's part of it. But also keep in mind that Woodrow Wilson's a progressive. He knows a lot of his supporters are progressives. And so he works very hard to spin this into a progressive war. The facts on the ground help him to do that. The fact that the Germans are sinking everything with their unrestricted submarine warfare. Right. The fact that...
And by the way, submarine warfare at that time, Buzzkillers, is relatively new.
Yes.
And people think it's very dastardly.
Correct.
And unmanly and against the rules of war because it's sneaky.
And it's killing civilians.
In large numbers. Right. Each time. When a ship goes down, it's a hell of a lot of people dying.
Right. But and also keep in mind that in dragging the American people with him into a war in Europe, this is breaking with the tradition. We had fought Europeans, but it was always here. We had never gone to war in Europe against Europeans.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
That's breaking with a big tradition. And so it's got to be a war of a new type.
Well, and also people were probably sick of the fact that Europe was constantly at war.
Yes.
Throughout the 19th century, they don't go 20 years without having some sort of continent-wide wars.
Yeah. No, that was part of our sort of self-conception of American exceptionalism, is that we don't go to war all the time the way the Europeans do constantly.
Yeah, Europeans, you're supposed to be this great cradle of civilization, and they're bloodthirsty.
Right.
And fratricidal, they're going to war against each other.
Right. So
that's
Wilson,
my rant.
So Wilson and the progressives think that to go to war in this way, to break tradition, it's got to be a war of a new type. And so here's where you see phrases like, make the world safer democracy, a peace without victory. In other words, we're not going to sow the seeds of a purely hypothetical Second World War because the losers have been sort of ground into the dust in their defeat. So he wants to make it a progressive war. And the problem is it ended up not really being a progressive war. And so a lot of Americans then felt sort of betrayed by that. But if you look at some of the other foreign policy things he does, there's not a ton of, I'll put it this way, not a ton of good idealism, more of the other type. Like, for example, if you look at the interventions in Latin America.
Right.
This is the period when Wilson in particular seems to be sending U.S. Marines into countries every few weeks. That's an exaggeration, but people ought to know that between 1915 and 1934, the government of the country of Haiti was essentially the U.S. Marine Corps.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's a long time.
It's a long time, and it's the kind of thing that most Americans don't know, but Haitians certainly do.
Yeah, yeah.
Or the Dominican Republic, which was ruled by the U.S. for 8 years. Both of these were initiated by Wilson. Wilson sends troops into Mexico on multiple occasions.
And the whole Cuba back and forth.
Including a junior officer by the name of George Patton.
More on
him later.
Yeah. We're scheduled to do a show on him in a few weeks, I think.
Wilson famously says when he orders one of these expeditions and I quote, "We'll teach them to elect good men."
Wow.
Now, if you think about that for just a minute.
Yeah.
That is pretty arrogant.
That's implying that they are incapable of electing
Exactly. And that is very much a sort of a great power attitude in capital letters.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And that goes against the idea of self-determination because
exactly.
Wilson is saying you need to elect these type of people. Right. You need to do this. Your voice is corrupt.
You know, and that's a big part of his idealism at the end of World War I is, of course, self-determination. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the way the map of Europe has changed as, for example, the Austro-Hungarian Empire is broken up. Because it's destroyed in World War I. If you compare sort of ethnic maps with political maps, they're rationalized a lot. And you know, Wilson, what was it called? Was it called the Inquiry? Wilson had experts advising him during the Versailles Peace Conference. If you compare the before and after pictures, Europe is much more rational in terms of people, quote unquote, determining their own sort of futures.
Uh huh.
There are still a ton of problems. You still have some multi-ethnic states, right? But on the other hand, his interest in self-determination has some pretty strict limits. For example, people who study the history of our involvement in Vietnam might be curious to know that a young Vietnamese nationalist by the name of Nguyen Ai Quoc, later mm-hmm. known as Ho Chi Minh, is in Paris at the time and actually presents a petition to the great powers.
During the Versailles Peace Conference.
1919, during the Versailles Peace Conference, basically saying, hey, yeah, you know, this self-determination idea sounds great.
Yeah, yeah.
How about breaking us off a peace? Yeah. And of course, Wilson joins the European powers and essentially saying, oh, no, we couldn't do that.
No, it's only for European and European-derived peoples.
Right. Or, you know, look at the way in which the British and the French, for example, do treat Versailles as a traditional sort of to the victors goes the spoils, how the, you know, the so-called League of Nations mandates, i.e. new British and French colonies taken from Ottoman colonies are sort of handed
that's
over.
Right, yeah.
You know, there's no self-determination for Iraqis.
No.
Or Arabs, right? You know,
and that causes huge problems in World War II.
Enormous problems today. I mean, Iraq, you know, in Palestine, these are places that are sort of products of World War I in certain ways. Like, for example, in Palestine, where the British promised the same land to two different peoples.
Yeah, and you can see those borders. You know, they're obviously drawn on maps by people.
Exactly.
No interest in who actually lived there.
During the war, by the way, like in the Sykes-Picot Agreement, 100 years old this year, by the way,
where
the British and French divide up the Ottoman Empire. And
so Wilson definitely is, we can complicate his foreign affairs idealism by saying he has one ideal of ideal Europeans and then one ideal of people in the Americas who do what we say.
Right. Well, and not coincidentally, people of color.
Right.
So by the way, he also, you know, because these days progressivism is on the right is equated with communism.
Yeah.
It's also interesting to note that one of his interventions was joining the efforts to smother the Bolshevik Revolution.
Russia. I don't know anything about that.
Yeah. 1918, and the last troops weren't withdrawn until 1922. Because this is when pretty much all external powers feel, for good reason, threatened by the Bolshevik Revolution, right? The first successful communist revolution ever, and they're taking over a really, really big country.
Yeah.
Russia with its 11 time zones.
Right.
And the United States sends troops both to Russia in the Far East, partly to keep an eye on the Japanese, who have also sent troops in, but also in northern Russia, where they fight alongside British troops against Bolsheviks.
Wow.
Now, for years and years and years, of course, the communists made a big deal out of this.
Yeah, we're always being chewed at from the outside.
And you evil Americans, you tried to sort of smother the baby in the cradle, and you should, you know, you should apologize for this. It wasn't a huge intervention, it wasn't on a huge scale, but there were Americans who inflicted and took casualties in fighting against the Bolsheviks because he, like most outsiders, thought that the Bolshevik Revolution is a danger to world order.
Yeah, even though they may not have been great supporters of the Tsar, they thought the Bolshevik Revolution was worse.
Right, by the way, and let's remember when we're talking about Russian history, there are two Russian revolutions in 1917.
Yes, yeah.
There's the first one, which was not communist,
yeah.
but was sort of more or less a sort of a liberal democratic.
Democracy. Alexander Kerensky sort of thing.
Correct, and that was perfect timing for Wilson, because then when we go to war in early April 1917, he can claim that we're going to war on the right side, right? The British, the French, and the Russians, they're all democracies now, and we're against sort of evil autocracy as represented by the Germans and the Austro-Hungarians.
Right, and Germany and Austro-Hungary seem like oldie-worldy monarchies and all this thing that the Russians had just gotten rid of,
Whereas we're on the sort of progressive side that's looking to the future, and that helps him sell the war.
Okay, so this it's much, much more complicated than the whole foreign affairs thing, but also World War One and Versailles and everything else is so much more complicated than we thought, especially geographically. Never think about it. Wilson's vastly different ideas about things in the Western Hemisphere.
Absolutely, right.
Versus the Eastern Hemisphere. So what happens? He goes to Versailles for the peace treaty. They hammer these things out, and then how does it sort of eventually yeah. has Wilson proved to be this great international success?
Well, the problem is he's forced to compromise, which was a word not really in his vocabulary.
Yes, that's right. Yeah,
and that's part of his problem, as we'll see. But basically, the French and the British very wanted a peace with all sorts of victory. In other words, they wanted their sacrifices. Uh-huh. You know, the French lost 1.3 million dead in World War One.
Yeah,
so they wanted the spoils like after any victory.
Sure.
Wilson didn't want that. He wanted to avoid sowing the seeds of the next war by having a punitive peace. Basically, he's forced to compromise. The British and French, they get their punitive peace. It's debated among historians about how truly punitive it was. The Germans were very good at, by the way, playing up their pain after World War
One. That's right, yeah.
But they're forced to pay reparations. They give up their overseas colonies. They're not allowed to have a military or an air force or U-boats. So there is some humiliation in there. It is a punitive peace. There are territorial gains by the British and French. What he gets out of the compromise is he gets his League of Nations.
Right.
But
takes the idea home. What happens?
Yeah. So the British and French do agree to this international organization. They join it.
Yeah.
He wants
based in Geneva, right?
Geneva, correct. Yeah. Correct, Geneva. The problem is in American democracy with our checks and balances for an international treaty that a president signs to actually go into effect as far as the Americans are concerned, right. has to be approved by 2/3 of the U.S. Senate. Right. And by the way, we've done that several times in our history, that the Senate has rejected treaties signed by. It's not unique.
Oh, no kidding. I thought
it's happened. And okay. Also, like, for example, annexation of the Philippines passed by one vote.
Wow.
Sometimes they're very close. So, you know, it's a supermajority you need. It's not hard.
Yeah,
it's not
right.
easy to do. And so Wilson comes home and he asks the Senate to ratify this. And the Senate digs in its heels. Mm-hmm. A lot of issues here. The Democrats, partly because Wilson didn't pay attention to it, the Democrats lose control of the Senate in the 1918 midterm elections. Is now his personal rival in the form of Henry Cabot Lodge, someone who thought he should be president, is now chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And he and a lot of Republicans in particular have a lot of reservations. They worry. They are so-called conservative internationalists.
Uh-huh.
In other words, they're not isolationists. You know, I didn't use that term.
Right. Okay.
That's too simple. they're conservative internet. They believe in America playing a forceful role in the world, an active role in the world politically and militarily. But they're sort of lone wolves. They don't want America's hands tied at all.
Right.
There's a clause in the League of Nations covenant that is sort of vague and seems like it might commit the United States to playing a permanent role in an international police force. In other words, if there's a conflict somewhere, we may have no choice but to be militarily involved.
Wow.
So people like Lodge, they at least claim that that's their concern. So they want the League to be revised to take care of this concern. And here's where you get into Wilson's personality. Because he's incredibly self-righteous. He's incredibly uncompromising. You know, some of our voters today would love him because he refuses to compromise.
I think of a few candidates that are like this.
You know, notice the language, by the way. It's called the League Covenant. He believed that this is going to sound like an exaggeration, but he really believed, he's one of these devoutly religious people who sort of believes he's doing God's work on earth.
Yes.
And, you know, when the stone tablets are handed down, you don't call for rewrite.
Right.
You don't edit this, and basically no one messes with my league.
Well, and if the big four say it's a good thing, that is Wilson, Clemenceau, Lloyd George, and
Orlando of Italy.
Oh yeah, Orlando. Yeah. Sorry.
Right.
Those are the more or less the big drivers behind the league. If they say it's a good thing, by golly, we ought to swallow it.
Right. And also, it's a way of him helping everyone else swallow the bad stuff in the treaty, right? Uh-huh. Which is, it's a punitive peace, but we don't need to worry about another war because we'll have this league to preserve peace.
Right.
If Germans are really resentful and they sort of put at the head of their political system some guy with the funny mustache and a gravelly voice and he wants payback, it won't be a problem because we'll have this sort of League of Nations in place.
Yeah. Forgetting, of course, that he can ignore the league if he wants.
Exactly. Well, and also forgetting the fact that any international organization is only as good as the sum of its parts. In other words, if its leaders refuse to do anything, the organization by definition is not going to be any good, which is what's going to happen in the 1930s. Hmm. In any case, Wilson then thinks, well, since I'm refusing to compromise with the U.S. Senate, I'm going to take this to the people. So in the sort of late summer of 1919, he wants to, and you know, you see other presidents do this or try this, right? Could sort of go ahead, go above the heads of the politicians to the people.
And it often works.
Sometimes work. If you can rally support to the league in the public, they'll call and write, their senators and
representatives. Midterm elections. Right. And you know.
So he goes on this, right. So he goes in this 1919, he goes on this whirlwind speaking tour. And from all accounts, it helps destroy his already precarious health. And late September, early October, he basically has a near fatal stroke. And when it comes to the league, the irony is we design the league, but we never join it. There was a majority in the Senate in favor of it, but not a supermajority. And, you know, there were people who stuck to Woodrow Wilson's uncompromising stance in the Senate. He had support.
Yeah.
They vote for the, so there's not enough votes for the league with reservations because Wilson's people withhold their support. So they vote on all these various versions and none of them fly. So the United States does not join the League of Nations.
But and the league goes on. The league goes on.
Now, would it have been much more effective had the United States been involved in it? Maybe, but it presupposes sort of everyone willing to stomp on aggressors in the early 1930s, which is probably not going to happen.
Well, and also a league with the United States involved, but with an incapacitated Wilson, or at least semi-incapacitated Wilson, is not...
Yeah, it's not help either.
Yeah.
Right, but that leads into this other sort of domestic situation where for months our president is essentially completely incapacitated.
Oh, wow.
And the people really don't know it.
How are they able to keep that?
This is sort of an early media age.
Because only newspapers, really.
Only newspapers. We don't have TV. We don't have, you know, cable.
Radio's very... Infancy.
Commercial radio is really not a thing at all, and so it's much easier to control the press. Also, the press are not so sort of prying, and the press is a little more credulous, and they actually stage an event where they bring a few reporters into his room and they make sure that he's positioned on his bed so they can't see that basically half his body's paralyzed. So they very carefully control access, and then afterwards this sort of call it a myth. Certainly a misconception arises that his wife, Edith Boleyn Wilson, was effectively president of the United States.
His second wife. He recently married
Correct. Her. That's right. He remarried while he was president. His first wife died.
Died, yeah.
In 1914.
As far as I know, that's the only time that's happened. The first lady died in office, if you will.
Anyway, I think you're right.
Buzzkillers can write in and tell us what
you got that totally wrong. I know there were a lot of sick first ladies. Like William McKinley's wife had horrible health, but I don't think she died while he was president. Yeah. In any case, it's certainly true that she had a lot of power that most people would say she wasn't supposed to have.
Right, because she's not elected. She's not.
Right, and especially back then, the role of the first lady back then was not like it is today. That's certainly true. Not after people like Eleanor Roosevelt. Was she sort of de facto president? No, I think that's a gross exaggeration. She helped.
That's what we were taught in college. Well, I was taught in college.
That she was basically a sort of extra constitutional president of the United States.
Yeah. Not necessarily that she was running cabinet meetings or anything, but she completely controlled access to the president.
Right.
What she told him.
Right. Or exactly, was making decisions.
Okay, yeah.
Right. Now, it is true that she helped control access to him.
Right.
And but my understanding is she was more sort of a go-between, like sort of having contact with him and then sort of helping delegate to members of the cabinet.
Right.
Which is sort of what a president does anyway. Wilson would have done. But the notion that she's making decisions and sort of basically is occupying the throne, I don't think there's any evidence for that.
Yeah, absolutely, because when people say, well, we haven't had a female president. Well, we had Edith Wilson. Well, no.
Right.
That's an exaggeration.
Now, I mean, long term, the good news is that this episode is one of the reasons we have the 25th Amendment, which clarifies presidential succession and presidential incapacity. Because one of the problems at that point is that neither the First Lady nor any of his other close confidants were sort of willing to have him declared incapacitated so that then you know, the vice president or someone else could sort of start running the government.
So was the order of succession not clear in the Constitution?
The order of succession is clear, but what you do in a case of incapacity as opposed to death was not at all clear.
That's interesting.
And if you look at I had to look this up because I'm not an expert in the 25th Amendment.
Who is?
Exactly. Really? Who even knows what that one is? The 25th Amendment actually spells out that if the president is incapacitated and the vice president, I believe it's the vice president and a majority of the cabinet agree that the president is incapacitated, then they can sort of take over. Because, you know, in the absence of that language, the vice president only takes over if the president's dead.
Yeah, but this has never happened.
Right.
I mean.
Right.
So we've passed the 25th Amendment. Fortunately, we've never had to use
it. We never had to use it. Well, yeah, as far as we know. And also, by the way, I didn't know this. I did know, for example, between November 1963 and January 1965, we had no vice president.
Yes. That's
that was not covered in the Constitution either.
That's a very good trivia question. But yes, people think it's Humphrey, and it's not.
It's not. Not until he actually joins the ticket and then is elected in November 1964.
Yeah.
25th Amendment covers that too. That if a vice president succeeds to the presidency, he must immediately appoint a new vice president.
Okay.
Which is why, for example, Nixon immediately replaces the infamous Spiro T. Agnew with Gerald R. Ford.
With the non-infamous Gerald Ford.
With the not-so-infamous Gerald Ford. Yeah. Correct. So, okay, I guess that's a good thing. But by the way, we still, in my view, do not do nearly good enough job in terms of understanding the true nature of a president's health.
Yeah.
Presidents still have way too much leeway, in my view, in terms of how they can hide their health issues. I mean, if people knew the extent of John F. Kennedy's health issues, for example, I think he wouldn't have been elected president.
No.
But in this case.
But since then, sorry to go slightly off topic, off the wood man, if you will, but since JFK, have we had presidents who really were hiding serious things? I mean, one thinks of the West Wing where they were, the TV show where they're hiding the fact they had multiple sclerosis, which seems a bit extreme. But.
Right. Yes, it does. Not that I am aware of. Kennedy is a clear case.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
You know, there's controversy with Reagan now. We'll never know to what extent he just had bad memory and to what extent it was the early signs of Alzheimer's, which ultimately claimed his life.
Yeah, but also, I think, wasn't it also the case at that time that people didn't really know? Alzheimer's research was actually progressing at the time, so
that's
you could have misdiagnosed it
quite
true. Easily.
That's true. But, you know, I guess part of my problem is I can imagine a case today where a president has a serious health problem and we don't find out about it.
Wow.
And for example, I'm pretty sure that presidential candidates are not really required. You know, they take a physical and the doctor says, oh, he's perfectly healthy. And we're just expected to sort of accept that. So, maybe it's a problem that you can't really solve. But
anyway, so the woodman is laid up in bed for at least a little while with the stroke. Does he get any better?
Get better. From what I've read, one of the unfortunate effects of his illness is that it tends to magnify his already existing personality quirks, like his rigidity, his unwillingness to compromise.
But he also used to like to go out jaunting in his 1919
he
Pierce
was, he era. Was a big automobile enthusiast.
Yeah, yes. He must have stopped that.
Yeah, well, I think one of the last photos of him is him being driven around after he's president. By the way, he does not live very long after he's president. He dies in early 1924. By the way, in D.C., you can still visit his house.
Yeah, that's interesting.
It's on S Street, I think.
He retires to the diplomatic section of D.C.
Correct, really, absolutely right.
Which is sort of fitting for the international sort of ideas.
Right.
But what we're saying is one of the biggest myths is that there was no Edith Wilson as a de facto president.
Right.
She may have been his de facto chief of staff.
Right. And sort of a gatekeeper in a way, but making decisions, there's no evidence for that. And also because of his disability, he's not very much sort of an active hands-on president for the rest of 1920. Although at more than one point, he does have delusions about running for president again.
Wow.
Which is absurd.
Sure.
Of course. It's much better to have two Ohio newspaper editors running against each other for president, as happens in 1920. And people have been sort of – this is when progressivism is petering out. But partly because of – and maybe this is something else we could talk about briefly – is sort of the domestic climate during World War One, you know, before the end of the war, once we get in, there part of progressivism was, from the get-go, was a very strong sort of social control streak.
Yeah.
The social justice streak goes by the boards once we join World War One.
Sure.
Partly because it entails self-criticism, right? You have to criticize the country to make it better in terms of social justice. That all stops. Regulation of business stops, right? The so-called dollar-a-year men from business are brought in to run the economy during World War One.
Wow.
Right, the railroads are nationalized. The War Industries Board calls all the shots, prices, wages, allocation of materials. I mean, it's the closest we come to a communist government, basically.
That's fascinating.
Is during World War One. But also, it's a very dark time because there's this crackdown on dissent. Wilson's okay, right? This is the time
Red
when
Scare and things like that.
The Red Scare is largely at his feet and the feet of his Attorney General, A. Mitchell Palmer, right? This is when the infamous J. Edgar Hoover gets his career start cracking down on Reds. Yeah. The Espionage Act, which in general is a thing that was long overdue, right? It should be illegal for you to spy on the United States, right? We all get that.
Oh, that you mean it was not illegal before?
Holy cow. Nope. I mean, at least not in such
statute
clear,
law,
yeah,
if you will.
Clear yeah. letters, exactly. The Espionage Act also included strictures against, quote unquote, interfering with the draft. And it very quickly became clear what that meant is if you gave a public speech criticizing the Wilson or the war, someone in the audience might be of draft age and they might think, oh, this war's not worth it. I'm not going to go if I'm drafted. So if you're like Eugene Debs and you give a public speech condemning the war as unnecessary, you are not, turns out, just exercising your First Amendment rights. You are actually interfering with the draft. And Debs was arrested and sentenced to 10 years in the federal penitentiary.
Holy cow. That must have gotten rescinded because we have never gotten through the late 60s.
That part of it, good question. It could be one of those things that's still on the books but never enforced.
Right.
But yeah,
that was that need to write in and tell us.
That would not pass the smell test with any Supreme Court today.
No.
But and by the way, Debs only let out of prison when he's pardoned by Warren G. Harding. Wilson never pardoned him. Wilson the progressive never pardoned.
Wow, and you needed Harding.
You needed the Republican to come in and had to come in and pardon the socialist. But there was a huge clampdown on the IWW.
The International Workers of the World.
Yeah. All sorts of anarchists and socialists were deported. Mm-hmm. People like Emma Goldman, for example, the anarchist, she was deported. They clamped down on left-wing magazines and periodicals by withdrawing their third-rate postal privileges.
Wow.
So these basically had to shut down because they could no longer mail publications to their subscribers. They arrested all sorts of anarchists and socialists and threw them in the pen. I mean, it was a really dark time. I'll put it this way, interesting comparison. With the obvious exception of Japanese Americans, we generally did a better job in World War II of protecting civil liberties and civil rights than we did during World War One.
Wow, that's amazing.
And to me, that's the important test, right? It's not, you know, when times are good, how true are we to our values? It's when the chips are down. In World War One, largely because of the progressive Woodrow Wilson, we didn't do such a great job.
So Woodrow Wilson has this very strong authoritarian streak.
No question. Certainly once we get into a war that's righteous.
Yes, that's
right?
The key. Because we didn't mention he's very religious, very
Presbyterian. Very religious, right? It's like, so you need to get on board. And, you know, he would have argued because, he wouldn't use this term, of course, but because this is a righteous cause, because this is a war for democracy, we have to crack eggs to make an omelet. Some people are going to have to pay and some people are going to have to shut up.
Yeah.
You know, this is a time when municipal symphony orchestras refused to play German music.
You're kidding.
At least one German-American was lynched. You could eat sauerkraut, but you had to call it Liberty Cabbage.
Yes, I remember. Well, I don't remember that, but
right?
I know that.
This is where the term Salisbury steak comes from, because
call it hamburger.
You can't call it hamburger. Yeah, I don't know what they called wieners. They must be, I don't know, patriotic hot dogs or something. I have no idea.
I don't know. Tube steak.
Yankee doodle dogs. Whatever. But yeah, so I mean, to absurd lengths, we were everyone competitive super patriotism.
Yeah.
And this was all in a climate partly fostered by him.
Wow, that's fascinating. Talk about complicating the story, Buzzkillers.
Yeah.
I mean, you have him, you could look at it as him starting off in these various progressive ways with, granted, things like race that aren't so great, but then ending up in this kind of authoritarian stance.
Now, by the way, I forget the exact details, but it's, I wouldn't call it a myth, it's a controversy, just before we entered the war, he allegedly said in an interview with or a conversation with a journalist, made some comments about how what I hate about war is sort of what it does to us at home. In other words, it's become a much more sort of strict and unforgiving place at home. In other words, if he said this, he sort of understood that this is what happens at wartime.
Oh, and it's just, we don't have to do it.
Yeah. I mean, in other words, and it's almost like in a sort of a regretful tone. Now, wow. If he said that, that's interesting. We don't know for sure he said it. And by the way, even if he did say it, he also helped make some of those bad things happen. So trying to have it both ways, I guess.
Well, I have to tell you, one of the things that's both progressive about this show and authoritarian is that we like to think that we can improve. And also, we like to take into account the authority of the listeners who've been emailing us in droves saying that, you know, your show on the atomic bomb, your show on the Cuban Missile Crisis, and when they hear this show, they'll agree. They'll put it in with those that have been so fantastic. They want more. They want more, Professor
More?
Nash. Yes, absolutely more. So we're hoping that Professor Nash will join us as a regular on the show, and we'll talk to you next week, Buzzkillers.
Bye-bye.
Over and out.
This is Aunt Ginger from Professor Buzzkill, and you're listening to the Epicast Network.
Epicast.